Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In recent years, democratization has become the primary foreign policy goal for the United States. And our guest for this hour, Amitai Etzioni, argues that this focus has been a failure. The results for America have been disastrous, also for the nations that it has tried to democratize, and generally speaking, for the rest of the world. He argues, in a book that we'll be talking about here this morning, that we should completely reorient American foreign policy in order to minimize the threat to Americans and the rest of the world. We have to make basic security for everyone, not democracy, our primary foreign policy goal. He argues that democracy may follow basic security, but without security first, democracy inevitably fails. That is the argument that he makes in a recently published book that we'll talk about this morning. The title is Security First for a Muscular Moral Foreign Policy. The book is published by the Yale University Press. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Dr. Etzioni served as professor of sociology at Columbia University for 20 years. Part of that time, he was chairman of the department. He was a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution in 78 before serving as senior advisor to the White House from 1979 until 1980. In that year, he was named the first university professor at the George Washington University, where he is director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies. In 1990, he founded the Communitarian Network. That's a non-for-profit, nonpartisan organization that's dedicated to shoring up the moral and social and political foundations of society. He was, for a number of years, the editor of the Responsive Community Rights and Responsibilities. That's the organization's quarterly journal. He is the author of a number of books, including the book that we're talking about here this morning, and he's joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, questions from listeners are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Professor Etzioni, hello. Hello, Dr. Etzioni, are you there? Well, I'm not quite sure what happened there. I think that we had the guest all lined up, and maybe we had a problem. And I think that we actually have him on the phone, and maybe it's a bit of an electronic problem here. We'll see if we can get that worked out. And Dr. Etzioni? Okay. Let me just real quick mention again what we'll be doing in hour number two. That'll give me an opportunity to dance here for a little bit before we see if we can get our guest back on. Hour two, we'll be doing a show that we do every other month here on the program. It's a show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And our guest for the show is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And he's good enough to come over here every other month to take questions. The idea is that it's wide open, whatever might happen to be on your mind. He could take the question. He deals with people of all ages in his practice, with kids, with grown-ups, and the idea is here it's a regular opportunity to ask questions about health. We always say we have to be a little careful about doing diagnosis over the telephone, but the idea is here if you have some basic questions, you can ask him, and we'll see if he can help you out. So that's hour number two with Dr. Jeff. And here we're going to try once again, Dr. Etzioni. Well, I'm really sorry. We seem to be having some kind of little technical problem here. And I know our engineer in there, Jason Croft, is trying to figure out what the problem is. And if we'll get taken care of here soon, I hope. Well, now I don't know what's going on. Okay. Tomorrow, I can just tell you about tomorrow on the show. Sandy Mason's going to be here in the first hour. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. She is on the program once a month. And we take questions on things that grow in the home landscape. That'll be hour number one. Hour two, the guest is Mark Shannon. He's professor of mechanical engineering and also director of the Center of Advanced Materials for Purification of Water with Systems Center, long title, at the U of I. Basically, there, though, what we're going to be talking about is water, managing it, protecting that resource. That will be tomorrow morning in hour number two. Okay, we will try once again to see if we can talk with our guest here, Professor Etzioni.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. My apologies there. I'm not really quite sure what the problem was there.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'm very, very pleased that you could be with us. The place I think perhaps to start is, I think you have a nice turn of phrase here to discuss some of the problems that we have with our foreign policy. And you suggest that we suffer from something that you call multiple realism deficiency disorder is basically, we have a couple of problems here that we believe that the United States is all powerful and so, of course, can do anything. And that at the same time, we also believe that our political, our economic systems are the best of all possible worlds. So it is our right, some would say our responsibility, to remake the world in our image. And in that, I think that one would have to say largely, we have been unsuccessful.
That's very true. In the book, I tell a short little tale that when I fly around the country, which I do all too often, the person who has the misfortune of sitting next to me will sooner or later be asked the following question. There was a car crash, and somebody was pinned down, and they had to amputate his leg in order to extricate that person from the crash. And it's my experience that practically every time I tell that little story, the person next to me gets slightly angry and said, there should be a way to save his leg. Mm-hmm. Means Americans tend to be very positive and optimistic, and they're not willing to accept that we sometimes face tragic, very difficult, very painful choices. So I'm all in favor of everybody in the world having a good life, a free life, a democratic life, and respect for human rights. But the notion that we can deliver that is not only deeply mistaken, but it's a dangerous fantasy, because as a result, things we can do, and which are vital for our security and those of others, we don't do because we pursue those fantasies. And since this is kind of an abstract statement, if you allow me, mm-hmm. I'd like quickly to give what for me is the number one example. Mm-hmm. If in the book I have page upon pages of lists of presentations we have made over the last 6 years and before to the Russians, to Putin, asking them to allow free press, to allow competitive parties, to continue to democratize. Putin rejected all those gestures, in effect, and moved in the opposite direction for a basic reason. If he would follow what we tell him to do, he would be out of business, and very few head of states welcoming suggestions which will put them out of business. At the same time, the program we have to reduce our number one danger, that of nuclear terrorism, which the main source of tactical nuclear weapons, the small ones, which are like a trunk size, is Russia. They have 10,000 of them flying around, very poorly guarded. And the material from which nuclear weapons can be made are also all over that place, mostly in Russia. And we have a program called Nanluger, which blends down some of this material, buys some of that stuff. This program has not been increased by one penny since 9/11. So if you combine these two little stories, we push for them to democratize, we pay very little mind to the number one danger of nuclear terrorism, exactly what I would reverse. Sure, we like them to democratize. It's not going to happen. Mm. We surely could work with them because they also fear the Chechens, that we should much increase nuclear safety.
I think that you make the strong argument that the problem is that often when we think about the choices that we have in foreign policy, we act as if it's the choice between the first best choice and the second best choice, where in fact often what we must do is be willing to accept one of the worse choices. Now, and it seems that what you're doing is you're arguing for a very pragmatic foreign policy. I suppose that there are some people listening to that might say that it was in fact a rather amoral foreign policy. Is it possible, and I believe that you would argue that it is, to actually have a foreign policy that is both pragmatic and moral?
That's very well put. Very, very, very put. I do not want a real politics in which all we pursue is our interest. First of all, the security I seek is for all people, not just for ours. And that's why I argue we definitely should be in Sudan. We should have been in Rwanda. We don't necessarily should be in Grenada, Panama, and Haiti, where we're trying to protect so-called democratic regimes. Yes, we owe security to everybody, but there's a major, major moral point here. And that is, if you look at the laws of all civilized societies, and in effect many not so civilized, our first priority is on protecting life. If you take somebody's life, we punish you much more severely than practically anything else you can do, discriminate, rape, or whatever. These are all evils. But we consider taking life as worse. That reflects our values. We consider life to be our number, protecting life, our number one value. So when I talk about a foreign policy which puts security first, not only, but first, all I do is give the world what we give to ourselves. First of all, let's not kill people.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Amitai Etzioni. He's professor of international relations at the George Washington University. Well known, very well known. As a writer and commentator, he is a sociologist by his training, has written a lot about government, about society. He's authored a number of books. His most recent, if you're interested in exploring further these ideas, is titled Security First, and it is published by the Yale University Press. And certainly we'd like to invite people into our conversation. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have someone here to bring into the conversation, so we'll do that. Line number one, the caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
I think one thing that sort of clouds this whole issue is that if you really analyze what our foreign policy and to some extent our domestic policy really is about, it has nothing to do with establishing democracies. Certainly, I don't believe that our invasion of Iraq or Panama or Grenada or many other places had anything at all to do with establishing democracies, but rather they were about establishing compliant states that would, you know, do what is best for exploitive corporate interest for the most part, or allow us to have military bases and that sort of thing. It doesn't really have anything to do with democracy. Democracy is just a euphemism that puts a sugar coating on it so the public will accept the policies.
This is a fair challenge, and I actually would agree, at least in the case of Iraq, that the claim that we are out there to bring democracy was introduced only after the other two fairy tales turned out to be so untrue the story could not be maintained. So first, this was this question of nuclear weapons, of weapons of mass destruction, and then the Al-Qaeda connection, and democratization was kind of the third excuse. But more generally, I'm really, the book, Security First, is really not so much interest in the past. We're obviously going to get an election now, and we're going to have a new administration. And the question is, what should that administration pursue? And again, it may fall to other interests, but as voters, as citizens, we have a need to ask, what criteria are we going to hold them to? What do we at least seek for them to follow? And to the degree that we ask them or promote or wish that they go and forcefully democratize other nations, then we are pushing the next administration in the wrong direction. Our first duty is to see if we can get, I talked about Russia, let me just quickly talk about Iran and North Korea. In both cases, we did ask them to democratize. We did threaten, whatever our motives, what we asked them to do is to have free elections, to have free press, and so on. Now, both North Korea and Iran, through back channels indicated that if we would agree to give them a non-aggression treaty and remove some of the bases we built around their nations, they would be willing to give up their nuclear program, the nuclear bombing program. That should be our first priority. Then they're not going to give up North Korea under communist regime and Iran under theocracy. This is just to give a quick sense, feel what it is like. It's really like coming to Bush and say to Bush, first of all, I want you to give the keys to the White House to Gore. Then I want you to go and campaign for gay rights and abortion, and then I'll talk to you. I've been in Iran as a guest of the reformers in 2002, and I met some of the hardliners. Their hardliners are very much like some of our religious fundamentalists. They're very, very strong religious feelings. They're not going to give up on their theocracy because we threaten them or present them with various diplomatic presentations. They are much more willing to negotiate about their nuclear weapons because what they seek most is exactly what we threaten them with. They do not want us to go and come and overthrow the government. So here is a deal, and the deal is not for us to give up on democratization. There's no way on earth we can make them forcefully democratize. So the deal is, we let them be, let their own people change the regime if they give up on what is really our security issue, their nuclear weapons.
Well, if what you're saying is that democracy is a grassroots up sort of process, I'll agree with that. Mm-hmm. And certainly we should be about creating conditions that will allow that to happen rather than, as has been our policy, impeding that possibility at every turn. And that has really been the focus of our foreign policy. And I think that, you know, to paraphrase an old country saying, when you hear a politician talk about democracy, it's time to put your hand on your wallet. Thanks.
All right. Well, Professor, certainly, if we take, again, take the example of the United States government trying to have some kind of relationship with either Iran or North Korea.
Right.
If we begin as our very first step, mm-hmm. if we say to them, before anything else, what we will say to you is we will not use force to try to bring down your current government.
Right.
That we'll start to that. Well, a mutual kind of agreement says we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. How then, though, it seems as a practical matter, mm-hmm. does one government start to talk to another government when the political philosophies, the public pronouncements of those two governments are completely antithetical to one another? How do you even begin to have a conversation when it would seem as if your value systems are incompatible?
That's an excellent question, and I have a very far from theoretical answer. And the answer is Libya. The Gaddafi regime is brutal. He is about as far from democracy as you can go. He makes light of human rights, and he gave up on his program of weapon of mass destruction, and he stopped supporting terrorism. So we pressured him not to democratize. We pressured him through sanctions and in other ways to give up on his weapons of mass destruction and his support of terrorism. So we talked to him exactly this language. We say, we let your own people, we will send movies and books and Voice of America and BBC. We will advocate democracy, but not with the Marines, not with missiles. If in exchange you give up on what is our number one, two, and three problem, nuclear weapons. And what happened is he agreed, and we didn't come to inspect. We came with cargo planes and ships, and we took the whole thing away. This exactly, you see, my book was written a year ago. It was published this month. I argued that what we can do is North Korea. That is what's happening now with North Korea. We're now sitting down with a regime who is ideologically and philosophically and politically about as far from us as possible. And we talk with them, and we say, we'll give you food, we'll give you credits, we'll give you other source of energy if you give up on your nuclear program. And at the moment, it looks like that's a deal they're willing to buy. So this comes to show that the answer to your question is it can be done.
Mm. Just for a moment, let me follow up, and then we'll go on to another caller. Mm-hmm. Look at Iraq. Now, unfortunately, now this is retrospective, but ostensibly in the beginning, the administration said the reason that we needed to take action against Iraq and to bring down Saddam Hussein was indeed our belief that he had or was pursuing weapons of mass destruction. So at the beginning, that would have been the same. It would have been our same issue that we had with Libya was Iraq. If we had taken the approach that we took to Libya, if we had taken that approach to Iraq, do you think that that might have worked?
Well, the problem is that he had nothing to give up, so he didn't have them. So, but indeed, the question was at that time, because we believed in inspection, would he allow unencumbered, wide-ranging inspection to show the world that he didn't have weapon of mass destruction. Mm. Now, he engaged in his nutty policy that he believed that if he would fake and pretend he'd have weapons of mass destruction, nobody would dare to attack him. And that put us in a kind of a really a tricky position. But there, I think the cue would have been to have much better intelligence. Then we can go down a whole other field. We allowed our human intelligence to deteriorate because some people believed that we can do it all with technological means. And there are many other reasons. We believed the kind of people who kind of usually sell you phony antiques and got information with them about Iraq. There are many reasons Iraq went, policy in Iraq went sour. It was also a question that some of the people who advised Bush told him that in order to show that he's macho, he has to go and beat up on somebody, and Iraq looked like a weak sister. Mm. So the story there, I'd be the first to go on, doesn't fit.
Let me very quickly introduce again our guest, then we'll take another caller. Amitai Itzioni is professor of international relations at the George Washington University. He served as senior advisor to the White House, as president of the American Sociological Association. He also taught for a number of years at Columbia, at Harvard, University of California, Berkeley, and is author of a recently published book titled Security First for a Muscular Moral Foreign Policy. It's published by the Yale University Press, in which he makes the argument that American foreign policy really needs to change its focus from the democratization, which has been the primary goal now, at least in recent years, to security. Security not just for us, but for other nations as well, because he argues that, in fact, democracy may follow basic security, but if you don't have the security first, then you're not going to have the democracy. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next is a caller in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I studied you in sociology and want to make a prefatory statement that I just love your work, so please take this with a grain of salt. But I'm going to quote Benjamin Franklin. A lot of people say this is Jefferson, but I think it's Franklin, who says, "Those would give up freedom for security deserve neither." Mm-hmm. And I think that what we have become is such a nation of security-oriented wussies that we're not willing to go to bat for our freedom anymore. Mm-hmm. And that if we were, then you wouldn't be having this conversation with us.
Okay. Do you happen to be next to a computer?
Yes.
Why don't you Google that quote and see it's not quite the way what he said. It's actually very interesting because a lot of people, I agree with you, quote him that way, but it's not what he said. He said, those who give up freedom for the temporary security. But the point,
well, you know, 1984 says it's all temporary. And Bush says it's all temporary. I don't buy any of that, that it's all temporary.
I agree.
The government takes one of these moves, it never comes back.
Yeah, but let me go to your point, because your point is well worth discussing. The question is how we protect our own rights. And there is a danger that as we pile on more and more security measures, as some people say, we're going to do the work of the terrorists for them by changing our institution and government to the point we become kind of police state.
Yeah,
there is such a danger. But the question is how best to deal with that. And
well, who's the worst enemy?
Let me say Iraq. Give me a moment, and then I'll be happy to listen some more. And the record is very, very clear on that. And that is we have to give people basic security. We cannot give them 100% security, and trying to do so will undermine our democratic institution. But unless you give people the kind of thing which is missing in Baghdad, where you cannot go on the streets, you cannot send your children to school, you're not safe in your own home, under those conditions, people will demand a tyranny, a dictator, and will not stand up for rights. I lived in New York City when violent crime rate was very high. In those days, when a police chief said, shoot first, ask questions later, everybody cheered him. He wouldn't say it this today, he would be out of office in 5 minutes, because we succeeded in reducing violent crime to tolerable, barely tolerable levels. After 9/11, on December 12th, 70% of Americans said, forget about the Constitution, give me safety. Now that we didn't have a new attack for more than 5 years, the majority said, be sure not to invade privacy. So the first thing you need to have, even if your only concern is human rights and freedom and democracy, is some elementary security. Then we can talk about where is the proper exact balance, how much wiretapping we can allow, how much it needs to be supervised. But unless you give people basic security, they will not protect the foundation of the Constitution.
All right, I want to give the caller. You want to follow up? Go ahead.
First, you said give them 100% security.
No.
You took yourself out of the range of reality when you said that.
No, I said we cannot and we shouldn't try to give them 100%.
But you should never even mention giving them 100% security.
Right.
That makes a false argument right to begin with.
Right.
Okay. Second, we kind of knew something was going to happen to the World Trade Center. Nobody should pretend that they didn't know something was afoot with that. And your last point of whether we were more courageous now or then, there were a lot of people who still wanted to stand up and fight right then and not give up security, fight for security and fight for freedom at the same time. I will grant you that great masses swish back and forth like wheat in the wind. I will grant you that. It's sad, but it's true. But
the great masses are the democracy you talk about. These are our fellow citizens. These are voters. So what people tend to do, if the, quote, masses agree with them, then it's fine. And if you disagree with them, suddenly become masses, not voters. Our fellow citizens correctly first sense is to protect their loved ones and themselves. Your right to free speech means very little when you're dead. And so if you are living in Baghdad today, you want to be, first of all, sure that you survive the day. That your family survived the day.
Well, you've just given away all we believe in.
Then you want to have all the other things, and you ought to have all the other things. But some elementary security is a condition for democracy. We have introduced democracy in Germany and Japan. That's always brought up as an example where our effort at democratization succeeded. It also took 8 years and huge amounts of money, but that's not the point. The point is what we did first in Germany and in Japan is established security. Some basic level of security is the first precondition for democratization.
Let me ask you this question. In what circumstances, how do you decide whether use of military force is called for?
That's an excellent question. Genocide, mass killing of people, we should be there to stop it because the highest moral value it attaches to life. People trying to take out one of our cities with nuclear weapons, We will have to do everything which is legal and legitimate to stop them. So we cannot stop every bomb. We cannot, tragically, prevent from somebody blowing up an airline or a train in, or a subway in the longer run. But we can, and the book shows in very fine detail what we can do to be sure that there be no massive casualties. Most of this most dangerous stuff to us and to others is very concentrated. We know exactly where it is, and we can go and blend it down. Quick example. Eisenhower started a program called Atoms for Peace. And we went, and we and the Russians actually, built hundreds of nuclear reactors in very unsafe places like Nigeria and the Congo Sudan and such. And we gave them highly enriched uranium, which is also weapon-grade uranium from which you make bombs. So we started a program to go and buy back this dangerous stuff and give them instead lowly enriched uranium, which cannot be used for bombs, but can be used for other purposes. So what happened, we gave peanuts to this program. It has a smaller budget than my university. What we need to do is really put our mind to the fact that our first priority has to be protecting us from a nuclear terrorist attack.
I want to thank the last caller and go on. We have another one waiting here, line number one, also in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
I missed the first part of the program.
It's very difficult for us to hear. Maybe you could try.
I'm speaking up a little louder.
That's good. Thanks.
I missed the first part of the program, so perhaps I've missed something important. But it seems to me your basic premise is that the United States has had a foreign policy favoring democracy overseas. I think that that has always been the spoken claim, but it seems to me that if one examines our foreign policy, with the possible exception of one administration, it has never been our policy. And I would point to repeated instances of our having overthrown democratically elected governments, beginning with that of Pakistan in the 1950s, I guess, and repeatedly since then in the 70s when we have backed military juntas. Central America, when we overthrew the Sandinista government. More recently in Palestine, when Hezbollah won, was democratically elected, but we have frustrated their attempts to form a government. I think it would be almost impossible to show that we have actually had a policy of favoring democracy, except when the democracy that might have been formed was pro-American.
Well,
but actually what we want is a pro-Western, pro-U.S. government.
Again, my book deliberately pays very little mind to the past and is very much interested in what happens next. We have an election. We have a debate what our foreign policy ought to be, and hopefully we get a rather different administration. So I will in a moment talk about what happened in the past, but my main concern is what should we do next? So that's one thing. Second, there was in political science at least a very widely and very popular theory that the only reliable partners in peace are democracies, because democracies do not attack other democracies. And so Francis Fukuyama and many others provide an ideology which, whether or not it was sincerely followed in the 60s and 70s, it was a rationale which was used to attack Iraq. Second, many of the neoconservatives, I think, really believed that you can go and do it, that we also would benefit from it. It's true. But you could go and democratize the world. You're right that in earlier ages, we often did not live up to our slogans. And there you come to a whole other issue. But first of all, let me say again, I'm interested in what we do next. We have a question which should not be taken lightly. Let's look at the regimes we have been supporting, which are not democratic, like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Syria. Now, assume you had a magic lever, and you would pull it, and there would be truly free elections tomorrow. And as a result, all these countries would have a Taliban-like government, which would impose on their people a strict Islamic law by force and would support terrorists in other countries. Are you going to pull that lever?
It seems, though, that gets us back to the point, though, how do we have, the United States, I think, has been justly criticized for doing what you suggest, and that is to, in the interest of stability as we see it, supporting regimes that are fundamentally not democratic. Is it for the present that we have to, in order to have this kind of security that you're talking about, be willing to put up with that? I think that there are a lot of people that find that extremely discomforting, if not completely unacceptable.
I agree with that. And in my book, I argue very much that we should promote reformist liberal forces in those countries, because what happened as a result of oppression, many years of oppression, in which we played a major role in promoting it. We trained Egyptian police in torture methods, among other things. So I very much agree that in the past, the United States supported these authoritarian regimes, and one of the side effects of this is that now the reform forces, the democratic forces in these countries, are extremely weak, and what's left standing is extremist Islamist forces. The only question really is, I'm surely against continuing this policy of supporting these autocrats. The only question is then what you do on Monday, given this, the past I cannot erase. And the question, what I would favor, is building up the reformist forces before we throw it open to elections. Because otherwise, these people are going to suffer even more as a consequence of our past acts. So if you throw up, you simply walked around my question, if you throw up this tomorrow to free elections, and do nothing else. You don't build up civil society. You don't build up a free press. You don't build up a kind of constitution these countries need. You're going to get Taliban-like regimes. And so what we need to do, we need to push them, encourage them, cajole them, bribe them to move to democratization. The only question for me is, what's your first step? Is your first step calling for an election, or is your first step building up the reformist forces and the foundation of a civil society? So it's a sequencing issue, not a question that we, under any conditions, should continue to support the autocrats the way we did often in the past. Hmm.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I want to thank last caller and introduce again the guest for anyone who might have tuned in here. Amitai Itzioni is professor of international relations at the George Washington University, and we are talking about some of the ideas that you'll find in his recent book, Security First. The subtitle is For a Muscular Moral Foreign Policy, and it is published by the Yale University Press. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. I think we just lost the guest there. For the moment, we'll pick up the telephone and give him a call back, and we'll see if he can get him back on here with us for the last 10 minutes of the show. Amitai Itzioni has authored a number of books. He served as senior advisor to the White House. He has been president of the American Sociological Association, and in addition has taught at Columbia, at Harvard, and at University of California, Berkeley, and was listed as one of the top 100 American intellectuals in Richard Posner's book, Public Intellectuals. And I think we have him back on with us. Professor Itzioni?
Hi.
Good, very good. We have some other callers. Let's talk with them.
Okay.
I believe that we'll be going to a caller on line one, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I would like to challenge the premise that if we favored
democratic elections and democratic procedures in the Middle East, in countries like Syria, Egypt, and Iraq, that this would automatically lead to a Taliban-like situation. And I think that's a presumption that is not necessarily valid. Certainly in Syria, there is a very strong civil constituent. That's probably also true in Egypt, although there is the danger that it would go to religious extremists. Secondly, he points to our having fostered democracy in Germany and Japan. And I would challenge that on the basis that Germany had a tradition of democratic government in the free cities going back to the Middle Ages. There was a very strong element of democratic following prior to Hitler grabbing power in the 1930s. And I would question that Japan has a democracy even today. The government at present is very like that of the pre-1940 government. Thank you.
Well, Professor Ezioni, you want to speak to that?
I think you mentioned just before I lost your line earlier that you're running out of time. And there's some very interesting issues have been raised about the history of Germany. Since I was a Jewish child in Nazi Germany, I think I know a little about that place. Well, the German democratic tradition has been, before World War II, I would say fairly weak. The Weimar Republic was a very shaky, weak democracy. And what happened, anyhow, we don't have the time to go through the history of all these nations. Surely Japan has an imperfect democracy. But if you look for perfection, my God, I'm not sure how many governments are perfectly democratic, including our own. But to the main point about Syria and such, in part, this is an empirical question. The caller suggests that there's a strong civil society element in Syria. I think most other people would disagree with that. But it's very difficult to argue about the facts without going and doing kind of a new study of Syria. But nevertheless, my question stands, assuming for a moment that we face that problem, that if we are, for instance, we surely face it in southern Iraq, that the Shia are now going to take over Basra. And what they're introducing is maybe not exactly a Taliban-like government, but a very theocratic one in which they bomb shops, they sell alcohol, they kill barbers who shave your beard. And so there is a very... Oh, here we go again.
Well, I'm sorry we have lost the guest once again. I really don't know why it is we're having such a problem this morning. We'll give him a call and we'll get him back on. And I think then we have one more caller we'll certainly have time for. Perhaps others here, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. I hope in just a minute here we'll get Professor Ezioni back on the line. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. His book, if you're interested in looking at it, is titled Security First. That's published by the Yale University Press. Professor,
back.
Yes, good. Okay, go ahead. Did you want to finish up what you were saying, or should we go on to?
What I was trying to say is we need at least to address the question. If there are free elections, if we start with that rather than building up reformist elements, if we are willing to face the consequences.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. This is someone in Chicago on our line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I find these discussions pretty limited and frustrating. Let me explain. When I first came to college, I lived in a dormitory filled with students majoring in all sorts of fields. And we exchanged all sorts of opinions. There was a history student at the end of one hallway on the first floor of the dormitory who took his who gave us his opinion of mathematicians or mathematics, and this was that mathematics was an esoteric form of intellectual masturbation. And I look at these discussions, it's pretty much the same sort of situation. Now, very limited, and they have very little value because they limit themselves too much. What bothers me is that you have to look at the forces within the government, within the political life of the United States, and the economy of the United States, and determine who is it that runs the show here. And the problem is that you have one party that is not that. Hello?
Yeah, we've got you, caller. I have this feeling that we might have lost the guest again. I'm really not quite. I don't know why we're having so much difficulty this morning. My apologies to you and other folks who are listening.
As far as I'm concerned.
Well, you go ahead and say what you have to say.
Okay, my concern is that the Republican Party is not dedicated to democracy since the 1870s, 1880s, when the robber barons took it over, at least. It's been dedicated to maintaining and increasing the wealth of the very wealthy. And these are the guys who control the economy and politics in the United States. And these are the guys who are presently running the government and the Democrats are tending that way. So it's a pretty sad situation. Basically, I look upon the Republican Party as essentially a fascistic party. Because of the leadership and the followers who are no better than the good Germans who followed Hitler. So that if you're talking about trying to establish democracies worldwide, you're leading nowhere because the people who are running our government are not interested in democracies. They're interested in increasing their own wealth and of course, in Iraq. The situation was that they were interested in grabbing all the oil they could.
I need to kind of jump in here and again give the chance to our guest to respond. I think essentially, Dr. Etzioli, I think we have all the callers are on the same page here and in their attitude, at least toward the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exactly sure in what way you can respond. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah. Yes.
Hello?
Yes, are you, Dr. Ed?
You're so faint, I can't hear you now. I'm so sorry, I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, we can hear you just fine.
I see. I'm sorry to, if you can hear me, I can barely, but anyhow, I'm sorry that people feel so alienated.
Well, I think we're just going to have to call it quits here with the show. My apologies, really, to everyone who is listening. I just simply don't understand why we've had so much difficulty here with the phone connection here. I'm afraid that there's something on our guest's end of the conversation that keeps knocking him off the phone, and that's really unfortunate. We try to make sure that things like that don't happen so that we can have these uninterrupted conversations with our guests. I think we've given at least the basic idea behind the book, and if you're interested in reading more, you can seek out the book. It's just recently published. The title is Security First. The subtitle is For a Muscular Moral Foreign Policy. Amitai Etzioni is the guest. He is professor of international relations at the George Washington University. The book is published by the Yale University Press.